On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you've ever wanted to see Washington at full boil, this was the week to do it. Action, aliens, heads of state, cash in the freezer, Congress on the warpath. We had George Bush standing down on Dead or Alive and Bring It On, Hillary Clinton standing up with biomass and wonk speak, even Al Gore buzzing theaters with his Hollywood attack on the ozone hole. The GOP House and Senate have now drawn battle lines on immigration. Tony Blair and Israel's Ehud Olmert flew in to the Oval Office as Iran stayed defiant on nukes. Dick Cheney may get a summons. Bad news on Marines, and distant thunder as the mighty fall at Enron. Up next on Point, the wild week in Washington. Joining me now from Los Angeles is CNN political analyst William Schneider. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a contributing editor at the LA Times, National Journal, and the Atlantic Monthly. Bill Schneider, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And from Washington, Bennett Roth, Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Bennett, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests, especially Bill.
Good. Good to speak to you, Jack.
Bennett Roth, take us right to this immigration bill. Describe for us the gap between Senate and House, and can it, will it be bridged?
It's going to be a tough road ahead. The Senate, basically, one of the centerpieces is a guest worker program and enabling those who are in this country illegally to apply for citizenship, particularly those who have been here more than 2 years. The House Republicans are dead set against that, and it's going to be tough to bridge that gap.
How will it unfold? What's the timetable? How does it? When do they actually sit down? Will they sit down?
Well, I mean, they're going to be, you know, negotiating over the summer, and I'm sure they want a bill by September before they go home to campaign for the November elections. And so that's a pretty tight time frame. In the next month or two, they're going to have to come up with something at all, or basically say it's not going to work this year.
Bill Schneider, this looks like a kind of cup of hemlock for the GOP, so bitterly divided, and the president not able to swing the opponents of his more moderate view his way. Can this work? Can the GOP come together on this?
Well, it looks like it's going to be very tough because so many members of the Republican Party are just dead set against anything that looks like what they would call amnesty. McCain calls it earned citizenship, not amnesty. Those Republicans claim they tried it under Ronald Reagan in 1986, and it's widely agreed that that policy was a disaster. It just increased the number of illegal immigrants to the United States. It's going to be very hard to bring Republicans together. The interesting thing about the vote yesterday in Congress and the Senate was most Republicans in the Senate voted against it. Mm-hmm. Now, the House has a rule that says they won't bring anything to the floor unless it has majority support, not just from the House, but from the Republicans in the House.
Right.
And so the signal from the Senate is this bill doesn't have that.
Doesn't have it in the Senate, certainly doesn't have it in the House. So what do we have here? Is how do you read it, Bill? Is it a kind of a bit of the party chipping off to push this through as a president desires? Are the Republicans in the mass still on the conservative side of this issue, or is there a real split, something more like down the middle of the GOP here?
Well, you really have two political conditions. A president who's very weakened, even within his own party, and who's losing support from his own base, his conservative base. And we have members of Congress, particularly in the House of Representatives, who get elected, many of them, most of them, I think, from districts dominated by the Republican Party. They're not worried about being challenged by a Democrat. They're being worried about being challenged by a conservative in their own party. So their concerns and Bush's concerns are very different.
What's the bottom line calculus then? Is the GOP better off pushing this through and aggravating all that internal tension, or failing to push it through and being seen to fail when the president has asked so strongly for something?
Neither option is terrific. I think in the end they want to get something done. The problem is going to be for the conference committee, which is a very tough conference committee, including a number of senators like Jeff Sessions, who are dead set against what the Senate passed. Mm-hmm. They are not going to defend what the Senate passed. Mm-hmm. What they want is for the Senate conference and House conference committee to come up with something that House Republicans can buy. It's likely to be a good deal different from what we saw pass the Senate.
Jack Beatty, do you think the GOP's internal divisions are going to quash this bill in the end? Will it just fail to come together?
I rather hope that they do quash it because this bill really does nothing to stop the flow of illegal immigration. Experts agree and have said for years the only way to do that is with employer sanctions enforced. According to Byron Dorgan, in 2004 there were fewer than 10 employers fined for hiring illegals. That's the only way to stop it, and there's nothing here that will do that. I mean, there's nothing that will prevent the 500,000 to a million people a year from coming over the border. Indeed, the Senate bill adds 250,000 more per year of job seekers. And the effect of this, of course, on American life is to push wages relentlessly down for people at the bottom, notably legal immigrants, especially from Mexico, and African Americans. So a bill that does nothing about that, that does not put emphasis on employer sanctions and on hiring the people to make that work, the only answer to this, I think we'd be better off without it.
A lot to talk about here, but I want to get our listeners in. Andre is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Andre, what do you see?
Right now, I'm seeing a lot of talk, a lot of politics involved, especially coming from the Mexican side. One of the problems that I have is, what is Mexico going to do? How are they going to try to help us? I know they're, you know, on the harder side of the situation, but at the same time, they can no longer say, this is bad, don't put the troops here, don't. What are they going to do from there?
Vicente Fox in the country this week saying Mexico wants to be part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Yeah,
Bennett
that's
Roth.
Easy to say. That's easy to say. Then
It is easy to say and hard to pull off. Bennett, you've got Houston right down there on the border. What about Mexico's part in all this? Can it step up and make this easier somehow for the United States?
Well, I mean, part of the problem is economics here and the Mexican economy, and that's one of the reasons that's pushing many of these immigrants over into this country. And part of the reason for passing NAFTA and whatnot was to improve their economy so this wouldn't happen. Unfortunately, Fox has not been able to improve the economy down there to make a better situation. Also, there have been drug wars in places like Nuevo Laredo, which is also creating tension on the border and maybe perhaps forcing more people over into the side. So unfortunately, other than Fox is on this tour here, the timing, I don't know how well it's going to play in Washington.
Bill Schneider, George Bush came into office very chummy with the Mexican and familiar with the Mexican side of the border, a great buddy of Vicente Fox, liked to speak Spanish. The Latino vote was supposed to be part of Karl Rove's permanent majority. Is the GOP losing it? Look at the long-term consequences of this fight for us. How do you see them playing out politically?
Certainly, the president and a lot of Republicans are worried about that. It's a very fast-growing vote. The Hispanics are the largest minority. We saw the demonstrations here in Los Angeles and around the country over the last couple of months. So it's a big problem. They don't want to make the same mistake they made in the last century, in the 20s and 30s, when they appeared to write off the votes of growing numbers of immigrants, and that helped create a New Deal Democratic majority that lasted about 50 years. They don't want to make that mistake again. But the problem is they've got a large conservative constituency. It's the base of the party, which is simply outraged by any notion that their party could allow guest workers or amnesty or anything that sounds like that into the country. I think they were a bit surprised by the ferocity of the talk show hosts and of the commentators against what they were proposing.
And Jack, what about the Democrats? They've been kind of riding in the backdraft here, but their noises are much more open-handed. As Bennett and Bill pointed out, Democrats really helped push the Senate vote through last night. Does this play to their long-term advantage, or does that kickback that's so hard on the right hem in the Democrats as well somehow?
It could, and, you know, I mean, just from the point of view of the Democrats' core constituents, who supposedly are African Americans, 9 out of 10 vote for Democrats, you know, you could argue that they are selling them out, and that they're selling out the poorest Americans by really not getting serious about stopping the illegal immigration. And, you know, there's been a lot of misty-eyed sentimentality, Teddy Kennedy talking about his Irish grandfather and so on. Well, that's fine, but that was we're talking about something very different here. We're talking about a third world border to a first world country, and a third world country that is doing nothing to help its own people. You know, a Mexican immigrant caught, a man trying to go across the desert with the New York Times reporter. He was interrupted, and he said, you know, if we had a government that respected our rights and provided us with good jobs, we would stay home. And that's the truth of it. Now, maybe there's nothing they can do, but everybody who looks at Mexico says, you know, the oligarchy there is just so strong. And until they have a little, you know, until they have more justice, they're not going to be keeping their people at home.
And then there was that weary, almost downcast President Bush last night at a news conference with British Prime Minister Tony Blair at his shoulder talking about mistakes in Iraq.
I think the biggest mistake that's happened so far, at least from our country's involvement in Iraq, is Abu Ghraib. We've been paying for that for a long period of time.
We've been paying for a long time, Bennett Roth. A new tone last night next to Tony Blair. The Economist magazine calls them the axis of feeble. President Bush really looked just pale and out of it there.
Well, this is significant in that this is an administration that has always believed that admitting mistake was a sign of weakness.
Tony Blair in town, of course, he's having all kinds of his own political problems at home. Talking last night at a news conference with President Bush, he said the violence in Iraq should not deter anybody.
We should be seeing that as a renewed urgency for us to rise to the challenge of defeating these people who are committing this carnage.
Bill Schneider, first to you. Tony Blair has been at the president's side ever since 9/11 in a very evident way. Now he's a lame duck in his own right at home. Axis of feeble, the Economist out of London says. Here's a foreign leader, but he's had a political impact for Bush at home as that light dims. What does it mean politically for George Bush?
Well, he's the one ally that Bush could always rely on. He stood with the United States and paid a terrible, bitter price for it. He is a lame duck because he says he will not run again as the leader of the Labor Party, as, of course, George Bush is not allowed by the Constitution to run again. So there were two lame ducks enfeebled by their commitment to Iraq and somewhat contrite about the way that issue was handled. What does it mean for George Bush to see the two leaders together? They looked not just contrite, but they sounded defeated, although they, of course, acknowledged nothing of the sort. Mm-hmm. And Bush insisted on the line that he's had now for several months. We're going to win. Victory is in sight, because he knows one great political truth. Americans will not fight unwinnable wars. So the point he makes over and over and over again is we're going to win the war in Iraq, and especially because he can argue there's now, finally, 5 months after the election, a government in place in Iraq. You know what? The American people have serious doubts about that argument.
We're joined by Gerard Baker out of Washington for a few minutes here. He's U.S. editor of the Times of London. Gerard, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
What do you see as the message that Tony Blair's bringing to the United States this time? He's going to be talking a lot today about multilateral institutions and the UN. Is he saying we've got to get on a different track? What should the United States hear from the British Prime Minister on this visit?
Well, the trip, I think, is more interesting from the point of view of what Tony Blair is signaling to back to his own people in Britain. Actually.
Really? How?
Well, I mean, one of the most interesting things about it is the choreography of this trip. I mean, normally when the Prime Minister comes, he brings a large crowd of press of reporters with him. They come, they have a series of meetings, they have a big press conference at a good time of day.
Yep.
Here, it was very striking. He brought a very, very small number of reporters with him, very small staff. He came late last night. He had a press conference last night with President Bush at 7:30 our time, which, remember, is 12:30 in the early hours of the morning.
Middle of the night.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He's here. He's gone again later today. It's a very quick in and out vision. It's kind of the visit that nobody wants to talk about.
So really, why is he here? Are they planning war on Iran?
Well, it's been a long time since he's been here. Remember, it was like, I mean, this is the longest period they have gone in the last, since 9/11, without actually having a meeting. So it's been, it's the pressure for the two to have for some kind of a face-to-face talk, even though they talk by video conference at least once a week. The pressure for them to actually be seen together was quite strong. But the point I'm making is the political pressure in Britain is strongly against Prime Minister Blair coming here. So he's doing it on the quiet. What the reason they're here? I think the Prime Minister, I don't think Iran, I mean, obviously they've been discussing Iran, but that's the issue that confronts them, and the next steps on Iran, what kind of sanctions are going to be put in place on Iran, if possible, outside. It's clear now that the United Nations is not going to approve the kind of tough sanctions that the U.S. and Britain wanted. So the question is, can the UK and the US get together with France and Germany and maybe some other countries and have some sanctions there? So they were discussing that a lot.
I'm still not hearing the bottom line of why he's here. They can talk by telephone anytime. You describe it, he's almost hiding the visit from his constituents at home. So what's the point?
Well, Iran is the most. There are several
so
big.
It does come to that.
Mm-hmm. Iran is the first one, as I've just said. They have mm-hmm. to try and get in place some kind of sanctions regime. Chancellor Merkel of Germany has been here recently too. John Howard, the Australian Prime Minister, has been here. These are the countries that will take part in whatever sanctions are eventually arranged against Iran, mm-hmm. if they can agree them sometime over the next few months. So that's very important. Remember also, this is part of the series of meetings that the Prime Minister and the President have in the run-up to the G8 meeting in July in St. Petersburg. There's a lot of controversy over this meeting. There's a lot of pressure on both sides, both in Britain and in the United States, for Britain and the United States and other countries actually not even to take part in this meeting because it's taking place in Russia. And Prime Minister Blair is no fan of Vladimir Putin, the President of Russia, and there's discussions about how that should be handled. I understand one of the things that they have been discussing quite extensively today and yesterday has been exactly how the Prime Minister and the President and other countries should handle their relations with Russia, and in particular what they should do at the G8 meeting. So that's been important.
Gerard, let me ask you, Tony Blair's been at George Bush's shoulder for such a long time now, but he's going to be gone most likely before George Bush is. Gordon Brown in the UK likely to succeed him. How's that likely to change the U.S.-UK relationship? What can Mr. Bush expect from Mr. Brown?
You know, I think the general expectation is that Brown is a more old-fashioned, old Labour, seen by some as a socialist. He's Scottish. He got much more support on the left of the Labour Party than Tony Blair. And there's a general expectation in Britain and to some extent over here that relations between the US and the UK will not be as warm. I think that's actually wrong. I think Brown is actually, if you look at what he said, he's actually very pro-US. He's been the Chancellor of the Exchequer for the last few years, which is the finance minister, the equivalent of the Treasury Secretary. He's admired the US economy. He says very, very warm things about the United States. He's very, very skeptical about the European. He doesn't like Britain being getting much closer towards Europe. And I think also there will be continuing strong institutional pressure on any prime minister to maintain the relationship with the United States, to maintain a warm relationship. So I think we will be surprised, actually, at how positive and how strong the relationship actually is between Gordon Brown and George Bush. And, of course, one thing that Gordon Brown has going for him is that he'll take over in a year or so, and he'll only have to have the unpopular Mr. Bush as his partner for a year or so, and then you'll have a new president in 2009.
Gerard Baker, U.S. Editor for The Times of London, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of the music of these two men? I mean, they really have been kind of at the center of America's thematic expression of war and post-9/11 response. You saw them last night. What did you see?
Well, Blair always makes the best case for Bush's war. He did it again last night. He posited a sort of seamless web of terrorism around the world, conflating the terrorism within Iraq to Afghanistan to the threats to Western democracies, and said we have to stand firm against it. And Bush said that's a very good speech, and indeed it was. But, you know, you can't, an American at least, can't look at Tony Blair without great regret. This is the one man who could have stopped this war. All he had to say was, George, I'm not going to do it. Because we speak English doesn't mean we've lost our mind.
That would have stopped the war? George Bush would have said, okay, pistols down?
I don't believe so. I think the effect of Tony Blair's signing on to this was for many Americans decisive. And the fact that, well, my gosh, this well-spoken man, the Brits are with us, our allies are with us. If he had said, we're not going to do this, I don't know as it would have happened. I think it was within his power to do that. And, you know, he said to people that the reason he did it was to prevent the United States from doing it alone. The idea that the United States could be so isolated in world opinion, that would just be terrible. But on the other hand, I just can't, I feel that he could have played a decisive role, perhaps I'm wrong, in preventing this catastrophe.
Bennett Roth, now Tony Blair says, world, look, we've got an elected government here. It's time for the global community, for the UN to step up and join the U.S. and U.K., even as the U.K. talks about drawing down troops. Is there an expectation in Washington that there might be any substance to that, or is this the U.S. kind of on its own hook for the long haul here?
Well, I think it's wishful thinking. I mean, you're not seeing any of the countries in Europe, and particularly, like, take Italy, which is withdrawing its troops, and, you know, Berlusconi recently lost, and he was another firm ally of Bush, and he was defeated.
Aznar out in Spain, yep.
In Spain as well. Now, in Germany, you've had just the opposite. You probably have a more sympathetic president there. But at the same time, I don't think the German population is really willing to join in on this. So I don't think you're going to see a stampede of Europeans headed toward Iraq in any time soon.
And Bill Schneider, you're our big political analyst here. The president's more contrite attitude on Iraq, can he win back public support with that, admitting mistakes this long after the fact?
I don't think it'll do him a lot of good, because Americans are disturbed by something that neither Bush nor Blair really talked about last night. That is the prospect that what's happening in Iraq is becoming a civil war, a war between religious sects, Sunnis and Shiites, mm-hmm. killing each other, militias going after each other. And when Americans hear about Sunnis and Shias and Kurds and all the internal strife, they immediately say, wait a minute, what are we doing there? This isn't our war. The president talked about insurgents, he talked about al-Qaeda, but he didn't talk about what Americans are seeing, which is what they see is the beginning of a civil war.
That's rough. Betty's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Betty, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I have to just inject a little bit of skepticism, sort of piggytailing on what this man just said, is that Bush being contrite, we have to consider the timing. The midterm elections are coming up, and almost everything that comes out of the bully pulpit of the presidential office now, we must look at through the lens of the Republicans trying to retain their majorities in both houses.
Yeah.
So even as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, gosh, maybe he is contrite. He's not contrite. Or if he's contrite, you know, I just don't trust it. I just don't. I'm considering that he's paving the way as much as possible to do whatever it's going to take to retain seats in the House and the Senate so that he can maintain his power.
The pressure is sure huge on that. Bill Schneider, what about those midterms? Can the president, by an immigration bill, by comments on Iraq, by body language, by, I don't know, traveling the country, can he pull it out for the Republicans?
No. What he needs is a real sense that policy is shifting, that there's a new direction, that Iraq policy is changing, Americans are beginning to come home, that the victory he keeps talking about is in sight, that gas prices are beginning to come down, if not stabilize. He needs something that looks like a real result. And all he sees around every corner is more and more trouble.
And this week, his own party on Capitol Hill in an uproar over the Justice Department going into William Jefferson, Congressman William Jefferson, Democrat's office. Of course, there was the famous cash in the freezer at home. Bennett Roth, what has got Congress, including Dennis Hastert, very high-level people, so bent out of shape about the separation of powers here with this Justice Department search of the congressman's office?
Well, this is very interesting because the Republicans had a chance. They've been beaten up for months by the Democrats on this corruption issue to step aside and let the Democrats take their licks, but they didn't. They muddied the waters on this, and I think there's a couple of things. One, they're afraid if they allow this precedent to continue, it'll be Republican offices that are going to be searched next because the Abramoff investigation is continuing and could implicate a number of Republicans. And two, I think this resentment over the sort of administrative high-handedness that's been going on for years just boiled over this week. I mean, they weren't informed on the Dubai ports issue, and they haven't been part of some of the immigration mm-hmm. debates and things like that. And they're finally saying enough is enough.
Your paper's cartoonist, Nick Anderson, has got an amazing cartoon of President Bush riding a great big octopus named Executive Power, which has grabbed, it's got Abu Ghraib and immigration and domestic spying and everything else in its tentacles, including the Constitution. And only now, when a little bit of that sucker goes into the congressman's briefcase, does Congress say, now you've gone too far. Here's House Speaker, GOP leader Dennis Hastert, talking with reporters about the raid on Democratic Congress. William Jefferson's office.
We think those materials ought to be returned. We also think that those people who involved in that issue ought to be frozen out of that just for the sake of the constitutional aspect of it.
Frozen out of it, the president says they're going to put all that material on ice for several months here. Jack Beatty, interesting that this is the line in the sand that Congress has drawn over, what was it, $90,000 in Congressman Jefferson's freezer and the raid in his office. Here's where the separation of powers issue comes home as a surprising point, given all the huge issues around separation of powers floating out there.
Yes, it is. And, people say there really isn't a constitutional issue here so much as a customary one. This was a signed warrant The Jefferson was not cooperating. They didn't seem to have much alternative. And, you know, in the background, he's denied it, and the Justice Department has denied it, but there was an ABC report that Speaker Hastert is being investigated. So it's, you know, don't do it in my backyard. Go ahead, whatever you want to do with AT&T and the phone records and all the rest, the spying, but gee whiz, don't look in our backyard. If I might, I just want to return a minute to the point of contrition that Betty was talking about.
Yes.
I didn't find the president contrite. He regretted his own words. He didn't regret the messed up intelligence, the no body armor, the not sending more troops. He didn't regret, you know. And then he talked about Abu Ghraib. Well, that was a terrible thing. But, you know, the president has put a signing statement on John McCain's bill saying, John McCain's bill said can't torture. The president's signing statement says, well, we will torture if we have to. So even the lesson of Abu Ghraib hasn't been taken in. So I didn't see any contrition there so much as a kind of narcissistic regret that he used the wrong language.
But from Abu Ghraib to Washington, issues of executive power, now separation of powers. Dana Milbank in the Washington Post writes today about the radicalization of Dennis Hastert. He was interviewed in Chicago yesterday, saying he will not be intimidated by these leaks that he may be pulled up in the Abramoff investigation. Bill Schneider, this is awful down and dirty fighting inside the GOP when the Speaker of the House is saying he's been intimidated by the White House with leaks on his honesty.
Yes, that's exactly right. These reports that we should point out came originally from a television network. They so far have
ABC,
been,
yeah.
ABC, and they have not been proved. So we got to be careful how we talk about.
But Hastert himself saying here are the dots. People can connect any dots they want to.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, there's a lot of defensiveness here. There is an interesting division going on, many divisions in Washington. It's supposed to be Republicans versus Democrats, total polarization of politics in the United States. But look what we have. We have a battle between the White House and Congress over separation of power and the use of executive power to go forces the FBI into a congressman's office, and the entire Congress, including Republicans, rebelling against its own White House. We have a battle between the Senate and the House on immigration. It's not Republican and Democrat. It's the Senate versus the House. These are whole new battlegrounds, the battle lines that we have not seen in Washington for quite a long time.
Al Gore in the theaters this week. Here's a little bit from the trailer for Al Gore's new film, An Inconvenient Truth. Here's Gore on the consequences of rising sea levels.
The Arctic is experiencing faster melting. If this were to go, sea level worldwide would go up 20 feet. This is what would happen in Florida. Around Shanghai, home to 40 million people. The area around Calcutta, 60 million. Here's Manhattan. The World Trade Center Memorial would be underwater. Think of the impact of a couple hundred thousand refugees, and then imagine 100 million.
Boom, boom, think of it. And then New York Senator Hillary Clinton, in an address to the National Press Club, talking herself into what she said was too much wonk speak about global warming.
We can fix these problems together by changing to a clean energy future fueled by innovation and efficiency. And of course, the alternative is pretty stark. If we don't change, our problems will only worsen.
Hillary Clinton apologizing for being a little too wonkish. Well, maybe, maybe not. Bill Schneider, are the Democrats standing up a challenge here? How do you see the Gore v. Hillary? How do you see Dems versus Republicans as the presidential race begins to come together?
Ah, the presidential race. That's what everyone's talking about. Gore put down a marker with this film. You know, it's put him back on the political roadmap. He doesn't strictly rule out running again. And I must say, there is some pressure for him to run from the left. A lot of people would like to see him run against Hillary Clinton. You hear it certainly from the liberals out here in Hollywood. I've always talked about a Hollywood primary where candidates come out to raise money and someone emerges as a front runner. And right now what you hear on the left is a lot of doubts about Senator Clinton.
Why?
Number one, can she win? Number two, is she selling out? They worry about her move to the center. And because of the things Al Gore has said, harshly critical of Bush, he endorsed Howard Dean, you remember, in 2004, mm-hmm. They see him as someone who very well could carry the left banner against Hillary Clinton, if he'll do it. And remember, that would be an amazing contest because you've got two people, both of whom can claim the Clinton legacy.
As vice president, as first lady in that White House, Bennett Roth, what's the talk in Washington about Gore and Hillary this week?
Well, I mean, it certainly was Hillary's attempt to maybe placate some of the left there. I mean, she at the National Press Club appearance, you know, she was heckled by an anti-war person, which shows some of the problems she's had, as Bill Schneider referred to.
Yeah, she triangulates toward the center a little there.
Yes, but this was her chance to basically go back to her base and say, I'm with you on environment. I'm every much a green as Al Gore is on these things. You know, I can do my Earth in the Balance sort of speech as well. So, I mean, I think that was an attempt on her part. And clearly, there's all that speculation about whether, well, is Gore really going to enter the president's race again. He seemed to really have bowed out in recent years, and now he's back.
But he never slammed the door completely, completely, completely. AJ's calling from Potsdam, New York. Hi, AJ, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I think the question comes down to, especially after the years of the current occupant of the Oval Office, whether you want somebody who comes across as maybe being pleasant and amiable and golly gee, aw shucks, gee, he mispronounces words just like the folks next door, or somebody who's sharp and real bright and on top of a wealth of information at his fingertips, or he knows or she knows where to get that information and make decisions accordingly.
So, but you're whipping George Bush back onto the campaign trail. He's done with all that. You're not going to have GW to kick around anymore. You know, it'll be McCain or heaven knows who. Do you think Hillary or Al Gore have got the stuff to make it to the White House, AJ?
Make it to the White House? I'm probably. Yeah, I think they're very capable and competent people. But I think we ought to learn a very important lesson, we Americans, not to mention the rest of the world, from the last several years. And we had better learn and make sure that we don't repeat this again, because I don't think that our society, our democracy, could survive it.
No, I hear that. Jack Beatty, a little wonk speak might be preferable to bring it on and dead or alive. I mean, we've got real issues we need to get our fingers into here, our hands around. Is Hillary the one to do it?
Well, I saw that speech, and Maureen Dowd, with a column called Enter Ozone Woman, had some fun with it, with the language. Hillary talked about unlocking the full potential of cellulosic ethanol. She talked about fee-bait tax incentives, hybrid plug-ins, flex-fuel vehicles, continuous reheat furnaces. Have you had enough?
Yes, enough. And yet we're running out of oil, too.
It's true. But you know, it really, to me, showed her glaring weakness as a potential candidate. It wasn't so much that she was boring. It is the pedagogical style. It is the love of the small detail. And it is the political dodge when the real question is asked. Someone said, well, what about raising CAFE standards so that we could get more miles per gallon out of our gas? And she said, well, now listen, there are a lot of jobs at stake there. Let's not rush into anything. Rush in. We haven't changed these things really effectively since the 1970s. So that seems to me to be prime Hillary. All this talk about all these cellulosic ethanol and all this jargon, but then when you really get down to something difficult politically, a fudge.
Bill Schneider, how do you see the can she win calculus at this point from the left and or the right?
Yeah, well, look, Hillary Clinton is clearly the front runner for the Democratic nomination, and having the opponent from the left, whether it's Al Gore or Russ Feingold or whoever, I think she might welcome it because it would make her look more centrist, more moderate. Can she be elected? Of course she can. Under the right circumstances, virtually anybody can be elected, and there's going to be a tremendous market for change in 2008, at least the way it looks right now, and she would have that issue on her side. If McCain is the Republican nominee, and there's a good chance he might be, for one simple reason. If Hillary looks like the front runner for the Democratic nomination, McCain is likely to look like the only Republican who can beat her. And that will get conservatives to say, well, we don't really like McCain. He's not our first choice. But you know what? We've got to stop Hillary. He's the only one who can do it. And you're going to see them gathering behind McCain.
Why won't he be plagued by the same dynamic that they've had around immigration? I mean, he's the one who stood up for this immigration bill last night that had the hardcore right, you know, just going out of its gourd. Why won't that plague him right through the primary? Will they really bandage that up if necessary?
Well, again, if he looks like he's the only one who can beat Hillary, and second of all, if the conservatives cannot join forces behind a single alternative, they don't have a horse to ride right now in the Republican primaries. Maybe Bill Frist, Sam Brownback, George Allen. I mean, they're being talked about, but there's no single conservative alternative to McCain.
George is calling from Greenfield, Massachusetts. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? I just am very underwhelmed by what I see in Washington these days. I see no real leadership, no inspirational leadership that I think this country is badly in need of. I think we're really in trouble. I wonder if anybody there sees anybody who really could pick this country up, who's really an inspirational type person. I don't see it in Hillary. I don't think she can be elected. I don't see it in McCain. I don't see it in anybody in Washington. And I find it rather depressing.
George, I think you speak for an awful lot of people. It's a simple, straightforward question. Let's go right at it. Jack, let's go to you. George is worried, and he's asking who on either side.
I hear this all the time. I mean, that we, you know, there are cycles in politics. There are times when there are leaders, and you can see them even before they're in high office. And there are times of mediocrity and cravenness, and people just unafraid to speak their pieces, or if they have something to say, it's not the right thing for the right moment. And I think this is one of those times. It's just hard to see, looking at the bench of both parties, a plausible president other than, frankly, John McCain. I mean, I do think he's a plausible leader, given, leave out his ideology, his positions, just the man's character, his bearing, his ability to get things done in the Congress. These are strong job qualifications.
Bennett Roth, you think John McCain can, will show that face to the nation, to listeners like George, that will bring comfort on this, pull us out of this malaise demand?
Well, I think a lot of it depends on how much he's pulled in the primaries, particularly to the right. If he feels like, you know, that he has to play to the right to get through the early primaries, he may start alienating that center that's always admired him. Just one point, this may be a good week to point out the passing of former Senator Lloyd Benson and Treasury Secretary, because maybe he provides a model of a politician that's no longer with us, one of those centrist politicians who was very pragmatic and was able often to rise above partisanship.
And, he knew Jack Kennedy, and that young would-be VP was no Jack Kennedy. On the other hand, Lloyd Benson hardly a kind of an inspirational, charismatic figure. Bill Schneider, do you see one? Will it be John McCain? Is there a new generation that may spring to life here?
Well, John McCain is the name that everyone thinks about, but in recent months, you know, his move to the right, where he really has to raise some money from the Bush fundraising base, has got a lot of people bothered. He still has support. He's one of the few politicians who has about equal support from Democrats and Republicans. That is rare. But again, the farther he moves to the right, the more he endangers that. The name you do hear among Washington insiders is the name of Chuck Hagel, the Republican senator from Nebraska. He's been an ardent critic, more severe than McCain, certainly, of the Iraq War. He's an independent-minded Republican. He's was a war hero in Vietnam. He has a good standing in Washington. A lot of conservatives don't like him or trust him. McCain kind of stands in his way, however. He was a McCain supporter in 2000. And if for some reason McCain were to falter or even not run, I think you might see a lot of people take a look at Chuck Hagel.
Certainly establishing himself as a more independent voice recently, yet big, tough issues from immigration to Iraq here. Let's get a call from Savannah, Georgia. Jonathan's on the line. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hello. I had a question. My comment was, I was watching CNN last night, and they were showing...
Jonathan, I'm having a tough time hearing you there. Let me get another call, if I may, from... we'll go to Barbara in Sturbridge, Massachusetts.
Hi, yes. My comment really is that I'm very frustrated. I'm frustrated with how the approach is being taken to this election already, in that you're discussing these people's personalities and not whether or not they can solve the problem. You were talking about immigration and how a certain person had alienated the right because they were so angry about the immigration.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an independent. I consider myself a moderate independent. I actually voted for Bill Clinton twice. And I'm mad as hell about the immigration issue. I'm not a right-wing conservative. And
You're mad from what? What's got you unhappy about it?
The illegal immigration issue. They are giving amnesty. Don't talk to me about the fine and, you know, the
right.
Wait. It's amnesty. If they get to stay here, it's amnesty. They're not guaranteeing they're going to shut the border before they give this amnesty out. We're going to have a flood of people trying to get over here before they finally get the border shut.
So you're not looking for a personality. You're looking for an agenda of policies. Is Hillary Clinton giving you that? She's centricizing here.
No, she's not. I'm not hearing it from really anyone, and what I'm not also not hearing is the media demanding that they do this. I can't call Hillary Clinton and say, you know, you're frustrating me. There's thousands and thousands of people. Everybody that I sit with at my lunch table every day has the same complaints that I have. No one is hearing us. The media, it isn't representing me. My representatives aren't representing me. I send emails. I make phone calls to, you know, my senators and my representatives to tell them that I'm frustrated, and nobody hears it.
Well, we're trying to listen, Barbara. We hear you today. Let me get another call from Waterloo, Iowa. Hunter's on the line. Hi, Hunter. You're on the air.
Hi. I guess I was curious to ask your panel why Barack Obama's name is coming up.
Barack Obama, you're breaking up, but let me put it to Bill Schneider. Bill, he's a first-term senator from Illinois. He made a good speech at the Democratic Convention, but what about Barack Obama?
First-term senator, not enough experience, attractive, interesting, gave a good speech, but I think people want him to get a little bit more seasoning. There's a good chance he could be on a ticket at some point, first African-American on a national ticket. He's an up-and-coming Democrat, 2008, might be a little bit too early. What that first caller talked about was the demand for a problem solver.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people want. What's emerging now is an enormous market in the center for someone who's distances themselves from the partisan squabbling and really sets about solving problems. It's the same thing we saw in 1992 that produced Ross Perot, who got a record third-party vote, 19% of the vote. People want someone who will get in and solve problems. The question is, if anyone wants to run as a third-party candidate, more power to them. There's a market for it, but you've got to have a lot of money to do that.
One more call from Charleston, South Carolina. Rick is on the line. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, the leadership we're looking for, Rudy Giuliani.
Because?
I consider myself to be a conservative Republican, but this country is in dire need of leadership, and I believe he's proven himself to be a leader. I believe he brings people together.
So bring on Rudy, who stands tall. Rick, our time is short. Bennett, let me put one more thing to you. We hear that Dick Cheney may be called to testify. That gets close to the Oval Office. What are the odds of that in the Scooter Libby case?
Well, it appears it could happen next year. Now, the point is it's next year after the midterm elections, so the political ramifications of it are maybe, you know, less than they would be if it was happening this fall, and it looked like, you know, the focus was on Cheney as maybe the source of all this leaking of the Valerie Plame's name.
So it could happen, but not until after the election. Bill Schneider, Rudy Giuliani, that's still the stand tall figure from post-9/11 time. Is that going to work this time in the problem-solving era?
It would be tough for two reasons. One is a lot of Republicans do not like his positions on social issues. McCain is much closer to where the party stands. And second of all, McCain is there. And as long as McCain is running, I'm not sure there's going to be an opening for Rudy Giuliani. If you want to have some fun, think about this. Suppose Dick Cheney testifies, is implicated in some way, decides to resign after the midterm election, which he can do. Then Bush gets to appoint his own new vice president. That would throw everything up in the air. It would be amazing because the betting in Washington is if he were to pick his vice president and thereby name his own Republican successor, he'd probably pick Condi Rice.
Condi Rice, who says she does not want it, would not do it. Jack, can you see that picture?
I can't see it. You heard it here. No, I think that a lot of people are talking about that, and for good reason. She's very well positioned. The polls show that although she's not wildly popular, she's certainly got better numbers than Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney. But you know, on this question of the people testifying, Murray Wass is reporting that Patrick Fitzgerald is looking into a connection between Karl Rove and Robert Novak, that they might have colluded in covering up Rove's tip-off. So we're going to hear more about that in coming days.
Lots of maybes. We heard that weeks ago. It didn't occur, but lots of everything going on this week. Bill Schneider, CNN political analyst, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Bennett Roth, Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Bennett, good to have you.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.